in Irregular Hours, episode 126 for August 25th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are here for the third part of our wonderful story, The Devil in the White City from 2003, Eric Larson's New York Times bestseller. And I still say it's a story, Pam. I still say this is a story.
It's a story. History is a story, my dear.
It's got the word story right in it.
And he said it was a wonderful story. I don't know how wonderful it is. It's scary.
Well, okay, so part three, we had speculated at the end of part two that part three was going to be much darker, that we were going to get more into the mind of America's first serial killer, and we really didn't in part three.
We did get a murder, though.
There's certainly murder happening. We still get every other chapter is our serial killer, and then the opposite chapters are Daniel Burnham and the World's Fair of 1893. But this part really, really sparks the conversation about the World's Fair more than the serial killer.
Well, with Pam and your permission, I will give us a little bit of background, what's going on in, I guess, the world during this time.
Sure. Yeah, hit us.
All right. So what we have going on is the Panic of 1893. And so this is happening as the fair is going on. So imagine you've put all these research and all this effort to making this a wonderful event. You're expecting all of your people to arrive and put their money down and make this a successful event. And then at that point, you have a deep recession just hammering away at the economy, and obviously a lot of people are uncertain about what their livelihood's going to be. So that puts a damper on how this event is going to play out. So there's a lot to build up on this, and I'm going to run through just some thoughts on it and what may have caused it and how we should kind of look at it at the time. We can go back to the founding of our country when we eventually come up with our Constitution, and that Congress has the power to coin money and to regulate the money after that. And what we determined we were going to do is have a bimetal situation, and that's going to be silver and gold. We're going to be the coins that we're going to have. And we should note that the federal government, while it has the right to do this, it didn't specifically say in the Constitution they have a monopoly on this. And so that should be noted, because it just plays out eventually on how we set ourselves. Eventually, we have the Federal Reserve System that is established, that we're currently working under right now. But the first bank of the United States is set up. Alexander Hamilton's part of that. And we create a weird system where we're going to, by law, determine what the rate of gold and silver, the ratio that they will be traded at. And the natural market, the market that we have, is basically setting at 15 and a half ounces of silver to 1 ounce of gold. And what does Congress set it up to be? It's 15 to 1. So obviously it creates kind of an arbitrage issue that's going on. Well, this is going to play out and be a factor in the Panic of 1893. 1834, eventually we have a switch in this, because Congress recognizes that this 15 and a half ounces of silver to 1 ounce of gold is pretty stable, and it's been very, very stable. But you know, since by law we've set up the opposite of that, we've sent 15 and a half ounces to 1 ounce of gold. Congress, instead of using the 15 and a half, just says, okay, now it's 16 to one. So once again, they've missed their mark, and it creates all sorts of challenges. 1836, Andrew Jackson kills the Second Bank of the United States. By the way, that was the last time the United States did not have any debt. So there was a cost to that, if we look at it, but that was the last time the United States did not have any debt. That was that's something to note. We do have relatively free banking. We have individual competing banks. They are issuing their own notes based on gold and silver. There are services to redeem those notes and all sorts of stuff. But in the 1860s, when the Civil War is getting ready to start, both the South and the North basically get involved in what we call a little mischief. The South moves to a fiat currency. Basically, it was a currency that was not based on any particular metal. And ultimately, by the end of the war, the notes are worthless. So they sought to establish their own currency. The North basically issued something called greenbacks. And greenbacks were promises to pay eventually in gold and have them redeemed in gold. But as of right now, they were a fiat currency with the backing of the United States setting up. In 1875, after the Civil War was over, the federal government had to figure out how to redeem these. And what they ended up doing is saying by 1879 that, so 1875 is when the Specie Redemption Act is established. 1879, what Congress is going to do is they're going to have the ability to redeem all those greenbacks for gold. And what ultimately happened in January of 1879, when individuals who had these greenbacks were able to redeem them for gold because they had the backing of the United States and the faith that they would pay, well, no one really showed up to redeem them. I'm running through a whole bunch of stuff. We had a greenback party that was established. These were farmers who didn't really want to sound money. They were inflationists. And potentially, if you to go down the rabbit hole, Wizard of Oz was written in sort of to outline maybe, anyway, they had some interpretation of how this was set up. And this seems to be what the argument is. There's between, we have this inflationist group that believe that the government should basically continue to buy silver and basically inflate the currency. And then we also had a group of people who said, no, that's not a good sound money system. Before you come down on either side of it, it's much more complicated than what I'm kind of portraying real quick in this quick moment of this. But ultimately, it's creating some really interesting situations. In 1878, for example, silver, which had been incredibly stable for a long, long time because of an act forcing the federal government to buy silver, we start getting a different trading. So it went from 15.5 to 1 ounce to 18.5, 18 to 1, 20 to 1, eventually it's 30 to 1. Obviously, Congress is still buying at 16 to 1. And I know this is just a whole bunch of challenges, but the gold reserves are being drained, which brings us to the Sherman Silver Purchase Act that requires the government to purchase 4.5 million ounces a month and mint the notes at 16 to 1 trading. It sounds like 4.5 million ounces was the amount produced in the year. So the Congress was basically forcing it to be produced in a month. And you could see that there is a there's a real challenge of this, and gold is flowing out of the country. I'll mention someone called Grover Cleveland. He was a president. He was the first president to serve 2 non-consecutive terms. That means he was elected president. He lost the election and then came back and served another term as president. And the reason that was is because the president in between was Benjamin Harrison, and he was just awful. And we had this panic because of the Sherman Silver Purchase Act. At least that's what one of the causes of this. When you were elected president, you weren't always asked to, you didn't have a choice on who your vice president was. It would either be assigned by your party. And the vice president that served under Grover Cleveland in the second term was Adlai Stevenson. He was a silverite and an inflationist. So what Cleveland's group felt caused the panic of 1893, or one of the causes of 1893, the person who was backing him up as a vice president, if he would become president, he would follow the Benjamin Harrison strategy, and the strategy of the United States had followed for a while. That was what brought that as a real issue was Grover Cleveland had cancer. And this is one of the real interesting stories going on at the time is, in order to save Grover Cleveland, Cleveland had to have a surgery on a boat or a ship. And they had to remove the upper palate of his mouth along with maybe some of his jaw. And he survived the cancer because of that. Things slowly got better. We still had this lingering recession going on. This is all background to what's going on as our World's Fair is being created.
And I just wanted to say that I think one thing Eric Larson does really well is really embodies that panic. And so he moves through tons and tons of different characters. He gives us really specific examples of bankers or investors who took their own lives, who had enormous stress. And then he pairs that with what's happening with the Chicago World's Fair and the sort of anxiety of how do you get this thing built so quickly? Is it going to be ready in time for opening day? And of course, the answer to that was not quite. And so I think that in a way, he takes this big backdrop, which is not only a national backdrop, but in fact, a global backdrop, and then kind of embodies it in this really specific moment and this really specific city.
And they were trying so hard to make this a success. They needed a certain number of people to come through the gates every day of the fair for 6 months. They built this thing for 2.5 years for 6 months worth of time for everybody to come to the fair. And then in the middle of that, there's this huge economic panic and people don't have the resources to go to the fair.
And it's just not happening because of that. The people that are needed to make the fair a success, they're not getting those people to come.
And I was really fascinated by the idea that one of the barriers to fair attendance was the price of railroad tickets. And the railroad companies did not want to play ball. They were going to charge what they were going to charge. And so there was this big conflict between the city of Chicago and the many, many railroads that intersect at that space. And when the railroad ticket prices go down a little bit, now you suddenly do get many more people in the city.
I mean, corporations still want to make money even when money's not flowing because of, say, a pandemic.
I mean, there's a possibility, my dear.
Once again, this is another one of those stories that really fits our time, doesn't it?
Well, who says that the railroads had to serve the needs of this fair? I mean, that could have been negotiated beforehand. So, I mean, it's not just the railroad's fault that this is not happening.
It's totally the railroad's fault.
and I don't think Larson suggests that it's the railroad's fault. I certainly didn't mean to. But he's looking at the different factors, right? All these different kinds of factors that mm-hmm. have an impact that mm-hmm. Daniel Burnham is thinking. He's looking at the receipts every day thinking, we're not going to make this money back. The investment was enormous. And we're not hitting 100,000 until
suddenly they did. They needed to hit that 100,000 people daily getting into the fair. And then one day they came up with an estimate that some 300,000 paid visitors already had entered Jackson Park, more than any other full day's total and close to the world's record of 397,000 people, which was from the Paris Exposition that was certainly the driving force behind this World's Fair. Yet the morning had barely begun that day. The ticket takers sensed that something odd was happening. The pace of admissions seemed to be multiplying by the hour. In some ticket booths, the volume grew so great, so quickly, that silver coins began piling on the floors and burying the ticket takers' shoes. How amazing an image is that he writes here?
Yeah, that's great. And especially that idea of the silver coins in light of the history of silver and gold that Chip was just talking about. That's great.
So a lot of people stayed away for the financial reasons and because of the unfinished nature of the fair. The Ferris wheel, for instance, was only half completed when the fair opened. It was just a big half of a thing. And the enormity of the Ferris wheel, we talked about this last week, is just mind-boggling, but it was half done and people wouldn't go and spend their money that they were really in a financial trouble. They wouldn't go and see half of it done. But on one day, they saw a huge turnout. Turns out that the mayor of Chicago closed down the city to let everybody have time off of work to go to the fair. And Ferris himself was up on the Ferris wheel looking over the crowd that day. And he suspected that there were a million people in Jackson Park.
I'm going to add something to this. The organizers certainly made, playing Monday morning quarterback a little bit, made some challenging decisions. One is Buffalo Bill Cody, who was not allowed to set up within the park, was outside the park. And he was promoting, and certainly every time the fair did some penny pinching or did some kind of limiting factor on what they're doing, Buffalo Bill was like, I'll do it. And he continued to be successful regardless of what the what was going on in the World's Fair. Looking back, they should have let him in. Mm-hmm. Certainly, they would have been able to take at least half his receipts. And he knew how to promote. He knew how to get people there even during this time.
And I loved his big promotion where he had that 1,000-mile horse race where people had to ride their horse from where they had to have two horses and they had to end on one of their original two horses. And the person who won ended up doing the first 100 miles in a train with his two horses. I mean, that was just, there's so many funny little vignettes all the way through this. And I feel like if you were going to ask 10 different readers to pick out their favorite vignette, it'd be 10 different favorites. Mm-hmm. They're just the funniest little stories.
Yeah, Eric Larson is so good at presenting all of the big picture of this. And the Buffalo Bill Cody stuff is brilliant. Yeah,
so Buffalo Bill Cody, P.T. Barnum, and then Walt Disney. I mean, I think we got it.
Yeah. And then throw George Lucas on there because the idea, and then Steve Jobs. I mean, the idea of manufacturing a spectacle is certainly on display here. Yes, we have Daniel Burnham literally manufacturing a spectacle. Everybody should come see the beauty of this fair. And then Olmsted, who is in charge of the landscaping, the beautiful art that he was creating there.
So, Steve, I was going to bring up that on Monday morning, as you're reading the announcements to school, for the school, I think all the students stand up and they say something. Was that at all related to this?
Yes. The Pledge of Allegiance was written specifically for this time in 1893 as an idea to try to unify the nation's children. Francis Bellamy, an editor of Youth's Companion, thought it would be a fine thing if on that day, the opening day of the fair, all the school children of America in unison would offer something to their nation. He composed a pledge that the Bureau of Education mailed to virtually every school. Originally, it started with, I pledge allegiance to my flag and to the republic for which it stands. And yeah, if we were in in-person education right now and I got to do morning announcements, thanks for bringing that sore point up, Chip, we would recite the Pledge of Allegiance every morning.
Well, you didn't complete it. It really was a lot simple. It was Bellamy hoped it could be used for any country. It didn't have to be the United States. His goal was to have it, he hoped that it would be used by citizens of any country. So whether you're in Britain or in France or you know, wherever you were. And it was, I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And that was the entire pledge.
Fascinating.
And of course, there was a military salute to it also that you can look up online.
Yes, that has been appropriated by other groups since, so we don't do that anymore, Mr. Hessenflow.
No. We also got some music during this time, Steve.
Yeah, the people felt patriotic when they were at the fair, and they broke out in song, and the song that they chose was My Country 'Tis of Thee, which was thought of as the national anthem up until it was declared the Star Spangled Banner was our national anthem, and that was not until 1931.
And so for Pam, I was going to say it's the anthem to God Save the Queen. So you remember what this is.
It's a cover song, yeah.
God Save the Queen, you know. She ain't a human being. Is that what it is?
I think that's, yeah, I think that was a cover. Yeah.
That's right. My country, tis a thee. Sweet land of liberty.
There were plenty of patriotic songs at the time, and we didn't catch on to just having one national anthem for a long time.
Well, and Hail Columbia, which was written for, that was also being played. That was an unofficial national anthem. That was written for George Washington when he was the original president's march. It is currently used as the vice president's theme, so during ceremonial entrances. I had to go and listen to it because we don't even, for the most part, sing Hail Columbia. Mm-hmm. And Columbia, so that, you know, for our listeners who may not know, was the personification of the United States. So if you've ever seen in a movie, the Columbia Pictures, the Lady Liberty, mm-hmm. That is Columbia. She's the United States personified.
This is quite a moment that we wind up in the middle of here. This fair, again, they built this for 2.5 years, only to hold on to it for 6 months. And boy, we do things a little bit differently now, huh?
Sure. And I thought it was really interesting because this is in some ways the original theme park, right? Especially when we think of the big Ferris wheel. It wasn't intended as a theme park per se, but it kind of ends up being one. And I really like that idea of it being called the White City and being contrasted to Chicago in which it sits. And so in the chapter, Night is the Magician, I like the description. This is early in the fair. Despite its incomplete exhibits, rutted paths, and stretches of unplanted ground, the exposition revealed to its early visitors a vision of what a city could be and ought to be. The Black City to the north lay steeped in smoke and garbage, but here in the White City of the fair, visitors found clean public bathrooms, pure water, an ambulance service, electric streetlights, and a sewage processing system that yielded acres of manure for farmers. There was daycare for the children of visitors, and much fun was made of the fact that when you left your child at the children's building, you received a claim check in return. Then it went on to say, like, there was this anxiety that poor people would just leave their kids there.
And only one kid suffered that fate. Yeah, that was great writing.
But
there would be a great story if you're a writer.
Oh boy.
About that one kid that's left, and you know, all of a sudden it turned out to be something.
That would be a horrible story, Chip. Thanks.
Well, but he's saying it would be a good spark for a creative writing assignment. That's what he meant.
So the one child that's left becomes, you know, I don't know, Superman,
the president, or yeah,
or the president, or yeah, or does something unique, special.
And go. I have to say, remember back in the day when there were daycares and you drop your children off, they'd go to school, they'd go to all sorts of activities.
Ah, the old world.
Right? I was always the mom, I'm sure many of us are, who was like leaving school and driving and like terrified that somehow my child would be the last little kid sitting waiting for a parent at the daycare. But anyway, here's what I wanted to note about that passage. So this idea of the White City, which is a fantasy, right? A sort of utopia that's carved out, and a temporary utopia at that, because it's only going to be there for 6 months. This idea, think about what it's describing there. There's good sanitation, clean public restrooms, it has medicine, ambulance service, it has sustenance, and it has childcare, right? Which is one of those dreams of the parents of young children who are trying to manage their lives. And so I was kind of curious, this notion of bringing this giant enterprise of a sort of utopian fantasy space into your city, what does that do? Because a utopia always is a critique of your contemporary culture, as well as providing a sort of imagination of like, what could the future look like? Do you think that had an impact on Chicago? And like, what is Larson saying about that? Of making Chicagoans think, wait a minute, like, it's tough going back to our part of the city, the Black City to the north, steeped in smoke and garbage. That notion of using contrasts to sort of build like transgression, subversion, rebellion, to have people say like, here's what we want out of our city.
Steve's thinking that's a critique of the Cubbies. I don't. That's the...
I was thinking, what do you know about utopias, Pam? Well, you are our expert in utopias, and we love your great course where you tell us all about utopias. I don't know anything about utopias that you haven't taught me.
That's not true. Well, because I feel like we all have a utopian longing inside of us. Like, we all have that desire for a better world, right? Mm-hmm. That's what, like, the utopian genre, it just builds on what we already all feel, which is like things could be better than this. And so did you guys see that utopian impulse to this project?
Well, isn't that the hope? Isn't that the goal of this? And the goal is to show the city of the future, you know, mm-hmm. the Jetsons world. And what is Tesla trying to do when he has his
electricity?
You know, what are all the people trying to do who are making their presentations to the public? They're trying to show what the world will be, the city of the future, almost like those cartoons that used to come out in the 50s that we watched when we were young, where it's like the city of the future and everybody had a flying car and, mm-hmm. and you know, clothes were ironed themselves and food was prepared for ourselves. I mean, every time you, in your mind, as you long for what the future could be, what this is kind of grounding us and showing you what we think the future could be. I mean, is Epcot down at Disney, is that really the future or not? I mean, it isn't. It's just from a period of time, this is the technologies that will come to us and are available to us as we see things today.
And then I think at the same time, there's that question of if you go to a place of fantasy, if you go to the Chicago World's Fair, if you go to a theme park, like what does that do to you behaviorally? Does that sort of create this pleasure, this sense of imagination? Does it sort of make your own everyday life look sort of dark and bland? It's probably both, right? But I think that I feel like Larson does a really nice job of showing those contrasts. And I wonder if that's part of the reason, because I think there's something a little bit odd about being like, we're going to look at two guys, the chief architect of this big project and a nice, very, very numerically impressive serial killer. Wouldn't that be good to put those two guys together? There's something a bit odd about that project, right? Mm-hmm. But you think about it as the dark city and the white city. We think about it as utopia and critique, imagination and critique. I mean, it works, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the need for contrasts in order to understand human desire, human longing. And I feel like one of the things, and I know, Steve, you really liked this too, one of the things that's super interesting is all the different products that are introduced at this time.
This is such a tipping point in technology and all sorts of different new ways of doing things that were introduced in the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893. So many things came out of this. Zoom is a
Zoom that came out. No, I was thinking, Steve, that you could pretend like you're, you know, at Comiskey and you're selling these products and just shout them out as they're for sale.
All right. Cracker Jack. Cracker Jack. Who Cracker needs Jack? Yeah, that was introduced at this World's Fair. It did not exist before 1893.
Food with a prize.
That's right. Doesn't all food have a prize, Chip?
It's the original
Welcome
Happy
to the Midwest. Yes. The hamburger was not exactly introduced in 1893. There's all sorts of origin stories, but it certainly really gained notoriety in this World's Fair. Vienna beef hot dogs here in Chicago.
We
are very proud of our hot dogs. Hot dogs! That's a thing.
And what do you wash out a hot dog with, Steve, when you're at the ballpark?
Pabst Blue Ribbon was a beer entered into a contest at the World's Fair, and they say that they won the contest. Now, there's some question mark as to whether or not there was actually a contest and whether they actually won, but they have stuck with that and left that blue ribbon on their cans for 130 years. There's diet soda that was introduced.
Do they really call it soda here in Chicago, Steve?
Pop. You want a pop? You want diet? Diet pop?
For our Southern listeners, we call it soda.
For our East Coast, Pam, is it Coke? Is everything Coke in Connecticut?
No, we say soda.
Is that Boston where everything's Coke?
Well, some people say the South says that.
What kind of Coke do you want? I want an orange Coke. No. Just, that's an orange soda. Okay.
A product to be renamed soon.
Yes. Aunt Jemima, which is losing its name, was invented for the World's Fair 1893. Cream of wheat was first introduced there, along with shredded wheat. And I love Eric Larson's quote here. Seemed unlikely to succeed. Shredded doormat, some people called it. I agree with that wholeheartedly. Don't get me no shredded wheat. I don't want that.
Steve, is there anything that like Soylent Green introduced?
Soylent Green? I've heard that's made of people. That's the rumor.
Ah, the sweaty 70s.
Ah, the dirty, sweaty 70s. The technology of the time is also just as pivotal. The amount of use of electricity really came into the forefront of technology at the 1893 World's Fair. Edison and Tesla were both there with both of their competing versions of how we should use electricity. And one was good and the other one was profitable. So we wind up with AC instead of DC, except for where all of those electric engines that you've seen or ever used ever, the little vibrating thing on your phone, that's all Tesla electric stuff.
There's probably some conspiracies written about that. I don't know, Steve. Maybe we should look at the internet.
We should watch some of those movies. I haven't watched any of those movies yet. The recording of sound was first put together in this World's Fair, along with sending sound through telephone wires. There was a very interesting story about a band that was playing music in New York, and their sound was traveling all the way to Chicago, and we had live music from New York.
I can't remember what on the Saturday original, night. Oh, that's right. I can't remember what the original... When we answered the phone, it was like, ahoy, or something.
Ahoy, hoy. Ahoy, hoy. Yeah, that's, yes, I still do that. That ahoy, is still hoy. A thing. Ahoy, hoy. That's The Simpsons. All right.
You'll be an insider right there.
And a whole list of celebrities were at this fair as well. We already talked about Buffalo Bill Cody and the success, the huge success that he had being outside of the fair. But there was Annie Oakley there as well.
I was going to say, he's got kind of a troubling past with the show. I don't know if he could be played now.
True. There is that. There would be a lot of changes made to a World's Fair in 2020, that's for sure. Mm. President Benjamin Harrison showed up to open the fair. Susan B. Anthony was there, along with Jane Addams, Clarence Darrow, George Westinghouse, Archduke Ferdinand was there, Philip Armour, the hot dog king of Chicago.
Hot dogs.
Marshall Field, who was a big part of Chicago history. Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson were both there. And Helen Keller was at the fair. Mark Twain, I think, was the most interesting story, though, right, Pam?
Oh, yes. That was so sad. So he came to the fair, but then he got sick. He stayed in the city for 11 days, but he was just sick in his hotel, so he never made it.
And Larson notes that that is the most heartbreaking story, because there's not many more people that we can name as the most American person. And Mark Twain is that Americana. And for him to not have ever seen this fair is pretty touching.
All right. So I'm going to show you two that you missed, but really interesting. So we said Marshall Field, which for anyone from Chicago, that was the big department store. But we also had Montgomery Ward, which is a mega retailer at the time that no longer is around. And then, you know, we had Sears, right?
And Roebuck. Sears and Roebuck were both there.
And once again, Sears and Roebuck could be on their last legs.
I'll take things that are going to stop in 2020 for 1,000, Alex.
It's amazing all the brands that are created during this time. And, you know, how many are still around today, but, you know, how many eventually just kind of work their way out? You know, somebody comes around and all of a sudden you're dealing with Sam Walton or Bezos, Jeff Bezos, and pretty soon you're not relevant anymore.
Yeah, everything comes to an end, including this fair. But boy, while this fair was going on, there was the architecture. We really haven't talked too much about the buildings of this fair yet.
But Larson does, and that's us. So I really thought he did such a nice job of talking about the court of honor, and he sets it up as this really sublime place. Like, check out this quote. Although such interior exhibits were compelling, the earliest visitors to Jackson Park saw immediately that the fair's greatest power lay in the strange gravity of the buildings themselves. The court of honor produced an effect of majesty and beauty that was far greater than even the dream conjured in the Rookery Library. Some visitors found themselves so moved by the court of honor that immediately upon entering, they began to weep. And wow. I really like this idea of architecture as raising this sort of uncanny, sublime emotion in people. Often we connect the sublime to nature, right? To like those moments where you're in nature and it's just so overwhelmingly beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I think Larson captures Burnham capturing the architectural potential of sublimity. And so he talks about some of the details of how this effect was achieved. So the buildings in that court are enormous, 200 feet tall. They're all neoclassical and they're perfectly designed in concert. So they create this really coherent vision. Quote, painted the same soft white, all were so shockingly, beautifully unlike anything the majority of visitors ever had seen in their own dusty hometowns. Now, I paused at that because I feel like a lot of these visitors came from New York and DC and other, you know, not so dusty places. There's this sense that, I mean, he's pulling from, Steve, you're questioning me here.
I'm making a face, Pam, because have you been to New York? It is filthy.
I go to New York all the time.
It's gross. Chicago is so much better than New York because it burned down in 1871 and they rebuilt it. It's so much cleaner. The streets are so much wider and it doesn't smell.
I'm not Larson describes Chicago that way, but all right. But this notion of, people all coming from dusty hometowns. I don't know that you would call New York City a hometown either. Maybe some people would, but either way, I feel like that idea that just you walk into this fair, you're in this court with these gorgeous, big, really coherent white buildings, and you could be moved to tears, right? Mm-hmm.
And he wrote about the green of the landscaping and how well that worked with the white of the building, the stark contrast and the absolute beauty here.
And I think many of us, especially many people who are listening to this podcast, they've experienced a lot in life. I mean, you don't have to say that I've traveled the world or anything like that, but you know, if you've been downtown to a major metropolitan city and you've been to the country and stuff like that, you've got all these experiences you can draw from. But for the people during that time, travel may not have been easy. I mean, think about the trains, what they finally allowed people to do. They allowed people to come across large groups of land and see stuff differently from their particular place in the world. We start getting our first real world travelers. Mark Twain is a world traveler mm-hmm. during this time, but not everybody got to have those experiences. So I could see where an individual shows up to an area and is overwhelmed by it. I mean, Napoleon was fascinated with the pyramids of Egypt when he got there. Why? Because they're grand. Mm-hmm. I would think that this would be, it could be overwhelming to a lot of people. And obviously, H.H. Holmes, who we're going to get to, preyed on that, you know, this shiny dangling thing that's here in Chicago, this fair.
And the idea of painting it all white was a big part of that cohesive look that made that awe.
And I like, Steve, that you bring up that the white is in contrast to the grass, the green. It's also in contrast to the sky, right? And it's really designed that way. And just quoting from Larson again, the shared color, or more accurately, the shared absence of color, produced an especially alluring range of effects as the sun traveled the sky. So the great court of honor would look quite different in the morning, at noon, at sunset, as you get these large white buildings against that backdrop of the sky. And it was interesting that Daniel Burnham, he had really wanted everyone to enter and have to go through the court first. So he had the idea of where the entrance gates would be. And it just wasn't practical when you're talking about 30, 40, 60, eventually 100,000 people coming a day to that crazy day with the 730,000 people. So it wasn't practical. But Larson calls Burnham an aesthetic despot, which I'm sure was a title that Burnham would have welcomed. Yes, but that's right. I do have an aesthetic sense and I want people to experience things a certain way. And I think one of the things I really want to credit Larson for is his use of ekphrasis in this. Ekphrasis being the Greek term for when you talk about one form of art using another form of art. So for example, like a poem written about a painting, or in this case, a book of nonfiction that super clearly describes architecture. So using words to describe something that's totally visual and experiential. And I do think Larson does a nice job. You can kind of feel what that court of honor might have looked like, and also that sort of sublime feeling that would have come over many, many of the visitors, whether they had visited a lot of gorgeous architectural sites before or not.
So on your dictionary chip of Pam's things that she has taught you, ekphrasis, ekphrasis.
I will try to use it in a sentence this week. And
please report back.
Impress your friends.
That's a challenge, my friend.
My response to that is for Steve to look in his wife's eyes and then use some of these ekphrasis terms to describe her and see if that works.
That she is a work of art. She looks just like the Venus de Milo if I cut off her arms.
Yeah, that's probably not what I'm suggesting.
No, that's Weird Al. That's a Weird Al song.
So guys, with your permission, I'd like to talk about Chicago. Is that okay?
Yeah, but you got to do the accent.
Chicago.
I don't know if I can do the accent.
Well, you can do a Canadian accent pretty well.
I guess.
I'm putting on my northern accent. This is not my real accent, but okay, go on. Tell me all about Chicago, Canadian professor from Connecticut.
So let me ask you just a legitimate question. So do you guys think of Chicago as a character in the novel? Listen to me, novel, as a character in this non-fictional work.
There we are. Once again, it certainly reads like a novel. It certainly has a narrative that is certainly intriguing enough to make it feel like a novel. Chicago is not as much of a character as I would expect it to be. This is not the Hound of the Baskervilles, where the Moors are so much a part of the storytelling. Yes, we have the dark city and the white city, and this difference between, and yes, I know the names of the streets, and I know the areas in which he's writing, but this is not like Dan Brown with the Da Vinci Code, where I think that the geography of that story was a huge feature of that storytelling. I think it's in there, though.
I'm from a person who lives here, but not from here, I do think Chicago plays in here. I keep seeing when I say that Chicago, the people of Chicago, what they're attempting to do, what Lake Michigan means to this fair, and how it impacted, where they placed things, how they were built, how they underestimated what it would go in, how they carved out this park out of this neighborhood. Ultimately, we have at least one of the buildings left. That's the Museum of Science and Industry, but that was rebuilt with materials to last a lifetime.
More than 6 months.
Yeah. and it also was the idea of the people of Chicago, or Chicago, however we want to describe it, was really attempting to assert itself. I mean, from the prairie to becoming a world city. Like, if we talk about world cities, you talk about Paris and Rome and London and stuff like that. But, if you're in the United States, we would talk about New York and Chicago and San Francisco and L.A. and, you could say Dallas or Houston or whatever you wanted to say along with it. But certainly Chicago is interested in asserting itself. And because of that, it becomes a character because the city is expanding and growing. And we may talk about the Pullman stuff next week, but certainly what's happening in the area is important.
I feel like somebody who's from Chicago, I feel like I'm always fighting. We're always in second place and sometimes third or fourth place. So I don't see that fight as much, I guess, as an insider.
That's super fascinating because, again, as someone who like goes to Chicago maybe once a year, maybe once every 2 or 3 years for conferences or whatever, I definitely see Chicago as a character here. And I see Chicago as like the underdog character who's fighting against New York and fighting against Paris, exactly as Chip just said, to be seen as a world city and who's tough, right? Like Chicago is tough. And that idea of like, not just the people of Chicago, but the idea of Chicago. And I personally am a huge fan of Carl Sandburg, the wonderful, wonderful Chicagoan poet.
Never heard of him.
kind of a figure around Chicago, of Pam.
Of course, forgive me. But no, but I love Sandburg and I love his poem, Chicago. And the opening of that poem, with your permission, I'd just like to read. Hog butcher of the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler. Stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. I love that. And I feel like Larson kind of captures that feeling. And he has these funny little sections where like suddenly he just, you know, H.H. Holmes takes these two women he's going to kill to like a hog butchering location. What does one call such a place?
And a slaughterhouse. Yeah.
A slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
He just in like two paragraphs describes the exact nature of what happens to a hog between being fully alive and being a slab of meat. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like he picks up on all those elements, player with railroads, the nation's freight handler, the storms, right? That brawling city of the big shoulders. And in that long poem, which I would highly recommend to anyone who hasn't read it, in the end, we go through a bunch of different things and Chicago has a lot of weaknesses. But in the end, Chicago loves being hog butcher of the world. Chicago embodies and embraces being the city of the big shoulders. It's really, I mean, I feel like there's so much work in, there's so much narrative work, so much use of words to construct a city's identity. And I think Larson is actually part of that work when we're talking about the city of Chicago. But that's an outsider perspective. So, Steve, I'm fascinated that you didn't really see that in this novel.
Because it's just normal to me. City of Big Shoulders is something that we say every 30 days. That is how we talk about Chicago. It is that working class, blue-collar town, that feisty little brother of New York that's gonna be there. It's gonna do what needs to be done. The second mascot for the Chicago Rush football team was named Grabowski. He was a working man with a hard hat and a lunch pail, and he came to be a part of the football club. That's who we are. I am blind to that.
But Chicago is also looking to assert itself in other ways. I mean, because of what Sears was able to do for the everyman, Sears houses were built all over the nation. The catalog certainly made a huge impact. Chicago also looked, when I say white collar stuff, they were a banking center. For Chicago, because of the laws, certainly was one of the most innovative banks in the world at the time. I shouldn't say the world, at least the United States at the time. And certainly had their hands in places all over the United States. So it wasn't just this working class group. It was a place that was going to be a center of the world. I mean, Rockefeller put together University of Chicago. So he brought the best. He wanted to create the world's best university. I'm sure many people could argue that. So there's a lot more than just the working class people. This is a place that's going to be a place of innovation and certainly a place that's going to connect the world. In their eyes, they would like to come through Chicago.
And I think that's something that Larson really captures. That's all that I was thinking.
I agree.
Sure.
I totally agree with that. We get to the ending of part three. This is not the strongest of the endings of the parts, but this is not bad writing where we're ending part three and moving into, you know, we've got the joy of the fair at this point, and we're going to move into the, I think, we said it last week, I think we're going to move into the darkness of the murders in part four.
So yes, you know I love endings, so end of part three. Later in the next year came the wonder. There are hundreds of people who went to Chicago to see the fair and were never heard from again, said the New York World. The list of the missing when the fair closed was a long one, and then the greater number foul play suspected. Did these visitors to the fair, strangers to Chicago, find their way to Holmes's castle in answer to delusive advertisements sent out by him, never to return again? Did he erect his castle close to the fair grounds so as to gather in these victims by the wholesale? Initially, the Chicago police had no answers other than the obvious, that in Chicago in the time of the fair, it was so very easy to disappear. The secrets of Holmes's castle eventually did come to light, but only because of the persistence of a lone detective from a far-off city grieving his own terrible loss.
Finally, we get to a detective.
Right?
Well, we had at least one of the murders happen during our reading that we got to experience. And there's certainly some darkness that we have to uncover. But this is the part where they're going to bring in the outsiders. And all of a sudden, we're going to get the real illumination of what was going on at that hotel.
There you go. This is still great writing. I am so glad that we are reading through this, taking our time and analyzing a lot of the background. We talked about a lot of background for this, setting the stage for this real narrative this week. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve and Pam.
Pam, can we come back next week?
I think we have to for part 4 in the epilogue.
Oh boy, our last episode of The Devil in the White City. I hope you are reading along with us, paying attention. Your reading assignment is the fourth part and the epilogue to this story. We'll discuss that next Tuesday. We would love to hear from you. If you give us a call or a text, our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatirregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube. That's a thing that we're on now. You can find us on all your favorite podcatchers. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflaw.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We'll see you in the future. In Utopia.